Yogi, President Park University, and I'm pleased to welcome everyone to our 18th annual Dr. Jerzy Hauptmann Distinguished Guest Lecture. Professor Hauptmann was our internationally renowned scholar who established our master's program in public affairs as the university's first graduate degree program 28 years ago. Professor Hauptmann also taught at Park University for 50 years and still has students all over the world who remember him with great admiration, as do we all. Today, we're fortunate to have the leadership of another great scholar, Dr. Lori DePadova-Stocks, who is serving as our dean for the Hauptmann School for Public Affairs. And I'm sure Jerzy would be very proud of the progress she and the great faculty and staff of the Hauptmann School are making to move that outstanding program forward. So we thank them for all of what they do. This lecture is a highlight, not only for the Hauptmann School, but for the entire university each year. And we're very pleased to be able to come together here in this beautiful library. And so with that, I'll turn the podium over to Dr. DePadova-Stocks, and she will carry on with the program. Thank you.
Good evening and welcome. I'm not Crosby Kemper, if you can see in your program. He's next, but he sends his regrets. He was not able at the last minute to join us tonight, so I will welcome you on behalf of the Kansas City Library as well. I am tasked with the wonderful job of telling you a little bit about the Hauptmann Lecture Series. This Dr. Jerzy Hauptmann Distinguished Guest Lecture Series was established through the generosity of alumni, former students, students, colleagues, and friends of Dr. Hauptmann, and it was done on the event of his 40th anniversary of being at Park University. Dr. Hauptmann was in Poland, and he was himself an international scholar. We have here in the audience some key people who were a part of that process in 1991 of launching the lecture series. Would those individuals please stand? There you go. There you go. All right. One is Paul Galt at Parkville, a longtime Park University leader. The other person is Rosemary Plakas, a student of Dr. Hauptmann, who now serves as in the Library of Congress. She's in charge of Rare Americana for the Library of Congress, which means she gets to take care of the Federalist Papers, the Constitution, and these sorts of things, so constitutional papers and so forth. So we are thrilled to have her here from Washington, D.C. for this event. The first lecture was in 1993 and has been going on every year since that time. And it does what it was designed to do, and that is to bring outstanding scholars to Park University to address Dr. Hauptmann's three areas of interest and research. And those are democracy, which is tonight's theme, international relations, and public administration. This series has brought to Kansas City area an array of distinguished scholars, including a former U.S. Cabinet Secretary, a former U.S. Ambassador, and several renowned experts in international relations. All of them are listed on the back of your program. All of them are listed. Now, last year, we had our first international scholar from South Korea, Dr. Pansuk Kim of Yonsei University, who's also, at the time, the newly elected president of the International Institute for Administrative Sciences. And tonight, we are thrilled to welcome our second international scholar at this very special year of the independence of Mexico that was achieved in 1810, 200-year anniversary. So I want to say also that tonight also represents two other first for the series. This is the first time that the series has presented the lecture in partnership with other entities. And tonight, we acknowledge gratefully that this program would not be possible without the wonderful partnership we have with the Consulate of Mexico and the terrific venue and partnership of the Kansas City Public Library. And tonight is the first time we've offered the lecture here, downtown, just a short block from the Hoffman School for Public Affairs, and we have brochures about the Hoffman School available to you. If you didn't get the program and the brochures, please do so on your way out. The Hoffman School for Public Affairs is a downtown Park University entity located just across the Main Street in the Commerce Tower. So this evening, we are very pleased and excited to welcome our distinguished international scholar from Mexico, addressing the theme of democracy, which you remember is one of Dr. Hoffman's keen areas of interest. And our scholar will be introduced by the Honorable Jacob Prado, Consul of Mexico in Kansas City. Jacob.
Thank you, Lori. Good evening, buenas noches. There are no two countries in the world that are more important to each other than Mexico and the United States. Our societies are stakeholders in a deep and broad relationship upon which the future well-being and prosperity of both our nations depend. The intensity and complexity of this relationship is not surprising. We share a long common border, key common values, an integrated economy, an enormous transnational community with roots on both sides of the Rio Grande, and of course, joint security challenges. For that reason, it is a great honor for the Mexican Consulate to partner with Park University and the Kansas City Public Library in programs that promote the analysis and discussion of issues that have an impact on both countries, and particularly in this special lecture series dedicated to address such important topics as international politics, public administration, and democracy. This specific collaboration is part of the Consulate's program dedicated to commemorate in Kansas City the bicentennial of the Mexican independence and the 100th anniversary of the Mexican Revolution that we are celebrating this year. The idea behind this program is to promote a better understanding of my country in this important region of the United States, to advance the already positive and dynamic bilateral relations that exist between Kansas City and Mexico, and to strengthen the ties of friendship between our peoples. It is therefore a great pleasure for me to introduce one of the most renowned political scientists and expert on U.S.-Mexico relations of my country. Dr. José Luis Valdés Ugalde holds a master in political sociology and a PhD in international relations, both from the London School of Economics and Political Science. He's a former director and tenure lecturer researcher of the Center for Research on North America, CISAN, of the National Autonomous University of Mexico. He's a member of the Mexican Academy of Science and also the Mexican National System of Researchers. His areas of expertise are theory of international relations, political theory, globalization, integration and security, history and foreign policy of the United States, and North American studies. As an authority in the U.S.-Mexico relations, Dr. Valdés has been a member of the Evaluation Committee for the Fulbright-Garcia Robles Scholarship Binational Program, the U.S.-Mexico Commission for Cultural and Education Exchange, and the Advisory Council for International Trade Negotiations. In government, he has served as coordinator for the evaluation of NAFTA for the Mexican Senate, and as Deputy National Security Advisor for Risk Analysis and Academic Liaison. He was also president of Metropolis North America, a network of academics, government officials, think tanks, and civil society organizations that are encouraging policy and research on migration and diversity within North America. Dr. Valdés has more than 60 publications as an author, joint author, or editor. He was founder of the academic journal Norte America, published by the CISAN, and director of the Voices of Mexico magazine. Currently, He's a visiting professor at the International Studies Division of the Centro de Investigación y Docencia Económicas, an analyst in different radio programs, CNN en Español, and other TV networks, and a columnist in the national newspaper Excelsior. Ladies and gentlemen, please help me welcoming Dr. Valdez Ugalde.
Déjame el laptop. Muchas gracias. This first. Thank you very much for welcoming me. I am very proud to be here. I want to express my gratitude to the organizers and sponsors of the 18th annual Dr. Jesse Hauptmann Distinguished Guest Lecture, especially to Dr. Lori Di Padova and Eric Begrut's hospitality and kindness. My thanks go also to the Mexican General Consulate in Kansas, most in particular to the Honorable Jacob Prado, Consul of Mexico, and to Mr. Alejandro Siqueiros. Of course, it is my great pleasure to be introduced by Dr. Michael Drosch, president of Park University, which I had the pleasure to be today in their campus, a great campus, by the way. Let me know now, just make, I hope, a short, as I'm going to make it as brief as possible, trip through the history of the inter-American relations. I think it's important to start asking a question as to what is the importance of studying the United States of America and its relations with the Latin American continent nowadays. One central aspect is the rise of the U.S. as a significant actor within the American continent. In analyzing the genesis of the Colossus of the North, we can see the most important features that have shaped its expansionist character, addressing inevitably the effect that the U.S. has had upon the destinies of the various Latin American countries. The emergence of the U.S. as a dominant nation is explained by, among other things, its geographical closeness to the rest of the countries in the region, while this country's modern development and economic and political features are largely explained by the U.S. interest and influence in those countries' affairs. Or like Hegel used to say, there was no neighboring state in America with which the U.S. could have the kind of relationship which prevails among the European nations, a state which they will have to view with distrust and against which they will have to maintain a standing army. Canada and Mexico present no serious threat to the U.S. Octavio Paz, our national poet, has perhaps best elaborated on this geographical proximity from his own experience as a Mexican. He states that before becoming a reality, the United States was an image. He explains, and I quote, "That is not surprising. We Mexicans begin as children to see that country as the other. The other side is geographical, the frontier. Cultural, another civilization. Linguistic, another language. Historical, another time. The United States is running after the future while we Mexicans are still tied to our past. Metaphorical, it is the image of everything that we are not. It is foreignness itself. Yet, we are condemned to live with this foreignness. The other side is right next to us." Close the quote. Hence, contiguity is a historic category that gives an extraordinary new dimension to the frontier exegesis. Paz discusses the omnipresent condition of the United States in the life of the other countries of the continent. Referring to the universal and unique condition of the U.S. as a great power, Paz adds that the United States was the immediate example of this universality. Quote, "In its present, we could see a vision of our future, a telltale mirror, like the stepmother mirror in the fairy tale. Each time we asked it to show us our image, it showed us that of the other." Paz argues, quote again, "The U.S. is always present among us, even when it ignores us or turns its back on us. Its shadow covers the entire continent. It is the shadow of a giant." To us, this giant is the same one that appears in fairy tales and legends. A big overgrown fellow and something of a simpleton, an ingenuous sort who doesn't know his own strength and who can be fooled, though his growth can destroy us. The image of the good-hearted doltish giant is juxtaposed with that of the shrewd and bloodthirsty cyclops. A childish image and a licentious one. The ogre that eats children up alive in Perrault, and the ogre of Sade, and Prometheus as well, the fire of industry and of war, the two faces of progress, the automobile and the bomb. The U.S. is the negation of what we were in the 16th, 17th, and 18th century, and of what, since the 19th century, many among us would prefer us to be. End of the quote. In these rhetorical images, Paz sees the features of a paradoxical fascination, an enchantment that is linked primarily to the process of modernization always defined vis-a-vis the US, whether for or against. The result, as Paz says, is that our intellectuals and politicians, quote, passion for US civilization ranges from love to bitter rancor, from adoration to horror, end of the quote. The study of the and the implications of U.S. foreign policy towards the inter-American sphere that impacts on the development of modernity and democracy are, within the realm of international relations and historical sociology, both a challenging and a complex exercise. Even more, if we consider, as Alan Nye does, that, I quote, the Latin American continent represents a cultural bridge between Western Europe and the so-called Third World, it is, in Alain Rouquier's phrase, l'extrême Occident. In this sense, Latin America remains a historiographical frontier. End of the quote. At the same time, the US has developed itself into the most remarkable economic and political power from the second half of the 19th century onwards. And Latin America, the otherness, from the US perspective, has since struggled to secure its own space in the continent map, being relatively shaped by many of the events occurring in the region. The nature of the relationship has changed its form in accordance with the historical moment, and most importantly, it has been the genesis of the United States and its conformation as a nation that has, to a large extent, shaped the nature and features of the modern relationship with the Latin American countries. Accordingly, Paz discovers that, quote, the US enters our history during this second moment, modernization, making its appearance not as foreign power that must be fought, but as a model that must be imitated. This was the beginning of a fascination that, despite having changed form during the last 150 years, is still as intense as ever. End of the quote. Multiple aspects of this relationship could be pointed out. Still, it will be one of the aims of this lecture to emphasize not only the structural asymmetry there is between the so-called two Americas, but also to explore the workings of American expansionism within this duality depicted by Paz. The long history of US interest in Latin American affairs must be studied, bearing in mind the historical realities that have shaped the existence of the US as a nation vis-a-vis the nations of the South. Both US power and inter-American interaction must be observed in such a perspective as to grasp the significance that have had in the overall history of the regional affairs. As Raymond Aron notes, the French historian and political scientist and also sociologist, and I quote, by the end of the 19th century, the national purpose of the founders of the American Republic had been achieved. Throughout the ensuing half century, the Republic searched anew for a purpose and swung from one line of conduct to the other as whim dictated. As Van Alstyne, a US historian, has argued in his book, The Rising American Empire, American foreign policy has a vocabulary of its own. Phrases like Monroe Doctrine, non-entente alliances, freedom of the seas, open door, good neighbor policy, Truman Doctrine, Eisenhower Doctrine strew the pages of American history, but throw little light on the dynamics of American foreign policy. Thus, in the case of US policy in Latin America, it will not be an exaggeration to state that it could have not obtain its objectives had the U.S. not simulated that its interests were synonymous with the achievement of economic and democratic progress in the region. Despite this simulation, a long-lasting paradox of U.S. history, by the way, the U.S. was clearly committed from the very moment the opportunity arose to expansion, to dominate the region using whatever banner necessary for the achievement of such an objective. But in this respect, John Foster Dulles, one of the most powerful and influential secretaries of state and who served with Eisenhower from 53 to 59, has an eloquent opinion, and I quote, "Not for one minute do I think the purpose of the U.S. regional policy is to make friends. The purpose is to look out for the interests of the U.S." It was Denis Diderot who in 1778 enthusiastically supported the rebellion of the 13 British colonies against the British Empire as a sign of democracy and freedom. He envisaged this event as a revolution whose ultimate objective will be to offer to the European inhabitants an asylum against fanatism and tyranny. And he was right in his assertion in that the US was going to be, for a long time, that asylum which promised land and gave freedom to the Europeans who could not stand despotism in their own countries. However, this very event in US history also accelerated the transformation of this country. The declared purpose in fighting the War of Independence was stated as creating a new empire in substitution of the British Empire, or to put the thought in words hardly familiar at the time, a new national state. While the neo-imperialist future that shaped the U.S. presence in the world has to be measured, the problem of power appears to deserve fundamental attention if we want to understand what was going to become, for some time, the messianic despotism of the United States. According to Morgenthau, and I quote, "International politics, like all politics, is a struggle for power. Whatever the ultimate aims of international politics, power is always the immediate aim," end of quote. It seems, however, that in defining power, one must do so in a more specific context, referring to the actors involved in its execution. Power acquires a myriad forms according to the plan of its economic, social, or political conditions. In talking about aims, we are also referring to particular and private impulses, social forces, historical actors, and national societies, which turn the aim into an alternative entity depending on the context in which this exercise is produced. And this is what the US nation is today in 2010. The scope of the term aim in the international system addresses the problems of nations, states, and societies which are not the same among them. The origin, composition, nature, and place in the world order of such aims are created by specific historical conditions. Thus, the need to provide this debate with a historical explanation of the nature of power. Is it the case, then, that all political agents must exert power in the same terms and must pursue the same aims, or perhaps impose the same political conditions in the name of these aims? And yet, power might happen to be consistently shaped by the reality in which it is applied. It is its use being conditioned by the particular needs both of its reality to be such and the actors involved. Power cannot cover anything and everything. Its form as well as its content are brought about as a result of heterogeneous features within which it develops. It is also the result and the expression of diversity and constitutes, I quote, "the ambition of certain men or of certain people. It is not in itself a rational objective." Raymond Aron. In the context of the international system, the effective power of Aron must be understood as something resulting from what Gramsci calls the conflict of forces within a particular organical phenomenon in which only particular conjunctural crisis occurs. In this case, the organic phenomenon is an umbrella to understand the problem of power in its paramount expression. It also gives us the opportunity to understand the structural dimensions of the exercise of power in the international arena. It is the very existence of the particular party, whose nature stems from the particular features of the international system in a particular historical moment, which molds the organic phenomena and the nature of conflict. In view of this, the characteristics of international system had to be distinguished as the only way to make the appearance of forces within the international arena comprehensible, and thus the impulse that these forces are capable of giving to the hegemonic potentialities of one or more of the actors participating. In this respect, Raymond Aron again has noted that, quote, an international system is the ensemble constituted by political units that maintain regular relations with each other. Its structure is always oligopolistic, and in each period, the principal actors have determined the system more than they have been determined by it, its first characteristic being the configuration of the relation of forces. End quote. Through the process of constitution of the forces, there are the various physical scenarios in which certain struggles take place in order to obtain advantages over the rest of the actors. Such a scenario is employed by those who in the international arena have a position of relative advantage over the players. And in some cases, this advantage is given by geography, by means of which the correlation of forces is set up. In this case, how the map is used is the result of the distribution of forces. But the distribution of factors resulting from the so-called constants imposed by geography are often deceptive. It is not geography, but the projection on a map of a certain relation of forces which suggests the idea of friendship or hostility, original or permanent. Once this relation of forces changes, another policy becomes reasonable. Of course, the geographical distribution of alliances exerts an influence on the course of diplomacy. According to the space they occupy, the political units have different resources, different objectives, different dreams. Alliances have a relation to the respective position of states. The most powerful ally is less alarming if it is remote. If it is not a permanent ally, a neighboring state easily becomes an enemy. Aron's thinking raises the question, what was first? Force, diplomacy, or geography? And how does the international map reach stability? Although it is right to explore the ways in which the projection of the relation of forces takes place, is it not true perhaps that geography is the result of the political distribution of power within the international system? And if that is correct, so it is to say that the sources of the political units, as well as their space, objectives, and resources, respond to a sense and above all, execution of power. Aron adds, the word power in English has very broad or very vague meaning, since depending on cases, it translates the three French words, pouvoir, puissance, and force. Power is first of all, in the broadest sense, the capacity to act, to produce, to destroy, to influence. Then it is the capacity to command legally, to come to power, exercise power. It is also the capacity of a person, individual or collective, to impose his will, his example, his ideas upon others. Finally, it is the sum of material, moral, military, psychological means, or one or the other of these means, possessed by the three capacities we have just enumerated. End of quote. Aron's rationalization on the depth and the meaning of the concept is in some respects polemical. There is indeed one point upon which he might be extremely naive. His vision of power is based upon a legalistic and rigorous state of nature inference, which does not allow us to see the way power is handled in international relations, least of all, the US way of settling affairs in the inter-American scene. The execution of power and the use of the law are, in this view, closely related. One permits the other to subsist as far as they can give each other a reason to coexist without having to confront each other. Law and order have in this context a rationale, and they are also principles indistinctly imposed as the means to reach a world of natural order. Hence, it is worthwhile to note an aspect of the legalistic framework used by the US in this policy towards Latin America, namely, it dramatizes the dilemmas, freedom or anarchy, order of justice that the system is facing in order to legitimize the priorities of national security and thus broaden the use of the means of realpolitik. By insulating into such a normative avenue the other actor's sphere of action, the U.S. manages to grant itself the means to create pragmatic doctrines within the context of an ideal ideological context, whose ultimate end is the immediate aim, namely the imposition of a rationality of power which generally uses common sense, thus the need of national security, and as a common creed shared by the actors surrounding the United States. Respecting the law and hence others' freedoms seems to be both at the domestic and international levels a problem as old as democracy. It appears, however, that power and freedom are somehow opposed when they come to the moment of being two parts of a whole. They become irreconcilable. There is a stage, according to Norberto Bobbio, the Italian thinker, who, referring to social democracy and individual rights in which power and liberty are at odds, there are, he says, guarantees of liberty, taking liberty in the sense of what is known as negative liberty, as a sphere of action within which the individual is neither constrained by whoever holds the power of coercion to do anything he does not wish to do. There is a sense in which liberty and power can be contraposed as an antithetical terms, denoting two realms which are mutually conflicting and thus incompatible. In the relationship between two persons, as the power of the former is enlarged, so the liberty, that is, the negative liberty of the latter, diminishes. And conversely, as the latter enlarges his sphere of liberty, the power of the former diminishes. End of quote. This idea seems appropriate to be linked to the problem of international relations. Hence, this view of freedom and liberty as applied by Bobbio in the case of the individual could be equally applied to the case of international affairs insofar as the contradictory struggle for and between power and freedom takes place. What is more, if we are referring to the U.S. relationship with Latin America, and as Margenthau says, with other collectivities, the parallels with the political situation in the region are remarkable. The defense of the other within the framework of order and law, and thus the U.S. concern for the other collectivities, constitutes such a unitary ideology, according to which they should, statesmen or states, should not ignore the interests of those of other collectivities. But it is precisely here that lies one of the major problems in the study of this subject, and thus the difficulties that political realism encounters when studying the Latin American complexity. This seems to be the saga of the international system, the shortcomings of realism when approaching Latin America. However, there is perhaps one more addition to stress here. Realism aims at assuring security as the ultimate objective. Since the accomplishing of this objective in the continent started occurring in the context of Cold War confrontation, this limited the capacity of the U.S. to detect the true nature of danger and eventually blinded both diagnosis and political action. As a result, the apprehension has been drastically altered. Similarly, the recognition of the existence of national self-interest, which according to a realist analysis is inherent in all men and states, is also a starting point from which to make a reality of the unavoidable. This is to say, if power exists to make the world function from the very perspective of this power's concrete interests, and not from the perspective of the other's interest, which the former claims to represent, then the existence of unavoidable egoism is one of the bases that justifies power's actions towards the creation of a self-perpetuating mechanism that permits this exercise. Within this context, there will be two aims to which power is committed. A, to put power itself into practice, and B, to regulate or avoid the overflowing of egoism towards unbearable limits. This is to say, of course, beyond the control of power itself, which holds inherent risks of widespread anarchic disorder for the international or regional system. It is obvious, although remarkable, that one of the basic foundations of U.S. foreign policy is the almost religious character that foreign policymakers have imprinted on Washington's vision of the world, as well as in the elaboration of doctrines and policies. This aspect, as seen in the light of the Monroe Doctrine and the Manifest Destiny, was going to become a powerful tool for the protection of Latin America by the U.S., which at the same time justified and even sanctified U.S. interference in the control of the affairs of the nations of this region. The missionary content of U.S. foreign policy, and thus the commitment to preserve the rest of the world, although resorting to the same sentiment of historical destiny, has drawn different conjunctural meanings and purposes throughout the history of the U.S. But this missional character of U.S. policy has its origins in the Puritan conceptions and philosophies of the dissenting protesters coming from Europe. Allegedly, this destined the U.S. to an extraordinary historical responsibility to keep freedom, order, and progress in line with the principles of modern civilization and progress to which the U.S. was already starting to belong. And it was to a great extent in search of historical legitimacy that the U.S. started its pursuit of the future. Thomas Paine, representing the spirit of independence prevalent in the New Republic, wrote in his well-known pamphlet, Common Sense, published in the U.S. in 1776, of the extent to which the new Americans were committed keepers of the flickering flame of liberty. Thus, exceptionalist discourse and one both combative of all European imperialism and expansionists emerged. The unity of religious and political discourse described by Tocqueville positions the new republic and its founding fathers as God-like, imbued with a messianic vision and destiny, a new genesis towards a new historical reality in which Washington must have dominion over America. Non-secular components of U.S. foreign policy were going to be dominant in the elaboration of the U.S. conception of the world, and as a result of this, in the understanding of the Latin American realities and hence the policies carried out in this area of the world. Hence, doctrines followed ideology, and thereafter doctrines pursue the achievement of geographical supremacy. This idea, which had a very strong support within the new national society to be, and was going to influence deeply the character of Americans' feelings, can be best illustrated by the thoughts of Drayton, who was a leading planter and chief justice of South Carolina in 1776. The Almighty has made choice of the present generation to erect the American empire, and thus has suddenly arisen in the world a new empire, styled the United States of America, an empire that, as seen as it started into existence, attracts the attention of the rest of the universe and bids fair, by the blessing of God, to be the most glorious of any upon record. End of quote. In light with the latter reflection, it is clear that the U.S. seemed to have followed the path of history and mission and paid tribute to the culture and political attributes that gave this nation its sense of identity, its fundamental rationality. Because the U.S. achieved both supremacy and hegemony, not only as a result of its willingness and careful calculation to do so, but rather as a result of its very convenient and fortunate position in the continental map, I will underline the dramatic results of his policies in Latin America, while not pausing to consider in depth the contradiction that is likely to be found between republicanism and dominance, or between republicanism and imperialism. I will say, in line with the above, that what did exist was the physical phenomenon of U.S. strength and the stereotyped desire to acquire both space and influence in the regional sphere. At this point, it is relevant to ask a relevant question, a historical question that follows. At what price U.S. security had to be imposed? Why did security not share with democracy the former's achievement? Was democracy too much of a challenge for the U.S. geostrategic principles of dominance, security, and order in that it carried the possibility of inert structural, though generally moderate, transformations in the economy, the polity of some of the countries of the hemisphere? Was security possible alongside democratic change, or was democracy too much of a burden for the former? Shall we conclude that democracy and order were seen as luxury items for Latin Americans committed to the achievement of political progress? Is it the case today? Along these lines, it should be pointed out that the needs of justice are not necessarily the needs of order. That order is not necessarily the result of a sense of common interest in the elementary goals of social life, and that the rules prescribing behavior that sustains these goals and the institutions that help to make these rules effective are in fact not necessarily so. Hedley Bull's thesis on the compatibility of order and justice in the international system misses the fact that one of the major goals of order, at least after World War II, was to contain social change. But this containment conflicted with a wider task of order during the process of independence, in Africa, for example, and to some extent in Latin America, namely the task of regulating national societies. Morgenthau views justice and its moral implications in the context of foreign policy. Quote, "The state has no right to let its moral disapprobation get in the way of successful political action, itself inspired by the moral principle of national survival." End of quote. On the other hand, Niebuhr explains the relationship between democracy, justice, and legitimacy of governments in the times of absolutist monarchy, in terms that might illustrate also the contemporary expression of this problem in the realm of the Latin American reality. And I quote him, "Justice is always a secondary, though not a primary, source of authority and prestige. The primary source is the capacity to maintain order, because order is tantamount to existing in a community. The source of power is the authority of a government to gain consent without force." End of quote. There are, of course, various levels of analysis involved in grasping the full dimensions of this problem. Yet it seems that the problem of distribution of force and power at the regional level is at the center of the discussion. Without force, there can be no order and security. Without order and security, force cannot be achieved or executed. Force is then a permanent feature present in the process of materializing the conditions to make it endurable and effective. Force, in the name of order, could condensate force and order at the same time. Hence, the historical and cyclical need to dominate. Here it will be appropriate to add that among the contextual spaces in which the power of force is exerted, there are hierarchies and priorities, contents and forms, and shape that shape the struggle for spaces and influence. At this point, we might recognize a general, although in some cases reluctant, agreement to trade, accommodate, and submit particular interests to the will of the dominant actors. There is also a perennial decline and variation in the nature of this settlement, which in the end aims at achieving a relative balance of power. Through the achievement of a negotiated balance, it is possible to reach a basic agreement to interact. However, and here Spyman explains quite conclusively, experience has shown that there is more safety in balanced power than in a declaration of good intention. To preserve the balance requires action, not only against the neighbor that becomes too powerful, but also against distant states. The interest in obtaining agreement in international relations is also illustrated by Spykman in the following terms. The international society, as in other social groupings, there are observable, in international society, as in other social groupings, there are observable the three basic processes of cooperation, accommodation, and opposition. Not only individuals and groups, but also states maintain the three types of social relations, end of quote. Nonetheless, when it comes to the problem of reconciling balances of power and hierarchies, which is what really counts in politics, we find that the sources and channels of power are manageable only in that it is acceptable, as Bull maintains, that where one state is preponderant, it might have the option of disregarding the rights of other states without fear that these states will reciprocate by disregarding their rights in turn. Hence, the need to accept that while international law depends for its very existence as an opening system of rules on the balance of power, preservation of the latter often requires the breaking of these rules. End of quote. And this is explained by, among other things, the fact that a balance of power policy is, in the first place, a policy for the great powers. The small states, the medium states, unless they can be successfully combined together, can only be weights in a balance used by others. But although they are stakes rather than players, their interest in the outcome of the game is nonetheless great. A small state is a vacuum in a political high-pressure area. Apart from considering the U.S. national interest as a race to obtain limited ends through the use of variable policies, I will agree with Hoffman that in the foreign policy-making process, the actors define their national interests by giving primacy to the foreign policy needs and greeds in terms of the geopolitical situation of the country, its external rivalries, ambitions, and drives, and its diplomatic traditions. For the main objectives are possession, goals, the effective control of territories, population, resources, and markets capable of increasing the overall power of improving the geopolitical position and of raising the rank of the player. Allowing that the balance of power aims at creating consensus about the need for order, it follows that the defense of world order is the defense of a specific system of relations and interactions. It is a system of power in which a power holds the balance only so long as it does not commit itself. And when it has committed itself, there is a new situation in which the balance will probably be held by another power. Still, the idea of balance of power involves a high degree of abstraction, according to White. It means thinking of the powers less as a pieces in a chessboard than as weights in a pair of scales. To balance is to compare weights. The word balance has entirely lost its meaning of equilibrium. There is less notion of stability, more of perpetual change about it than in sense one. Weight, in this case, White refers to an even distribution of power. I will argue that this is probably the main issue in the entire discussion of power in international relations, is intemperance. Given then the struggle to produce a national foreign policy, it is essential to consider the cultural and political circumstances that precede foreign policy decisions. According to Bell, and I quote, "There has been little evidence that American foreign policy is guided by a sense of historical time and accurate assessment of social forces. Foreign policy has foundered because every administration has had difficulty in defining a national interest, morally rooted, whose policies can be realistically tailored to the capacities and constraints imposed by the actualities of world power. Americans have rarely known how to sweat it out, to wait, to calculate in historical terms, to learn that action cannot easily reverse social drifts whose course were charted long ago." End of quote. And thus, a pragmatic conclusion on this kind of pragmatic approach, a dominant power such as the US cannot risk its hold upon the strategic zone of dominance by tying itself to a steady policy. Thus, the inevitability of sacrificing sometimes rational policy. And what do all this have to do with the main idea behind this lecture of this Inter-American dilemma? Namely, the conflict there is between security, democracy, governance, and progress? Well, once this brief historical framework has been laid out, let me do some sociological history and address the current moment. And let me address some questions to you. Within the current context of the Inter-American picture, the question here should be whether security is working against prosperity and about forgetting on the right ways of conducting governance. Is there a place for Latin America in the very context of its own, the Latin American objective and contradictory objective, political conditions that it has been able to build up throughout time and within the US geopolitical picture? Are we dealing in the Inter-American field with a similar conditions today that those experienced during the Cold War years? There are very relevant elements, in my opinion, some of them of very recent existence when analyzing the current moment of US security strategy. At the Inter-American level, the most important issue to inquire about is whether security will subsume indefinitely other important issues of the US-Latin American relation, like progress and democratic governance. The end of the Cold War radically changed the global panorama and gave rise to the emergence of new actors, new global players, and issues on the international agenda which are currently challenging the current scenario of the world order. Thus, terrorism, drug trafficking, the fight against organized crime, and aiming at organizing a balanced governance order are some of the big problems to be tackled. Indeed, 9/11 produced a rigorous review of US security doctrine, giving rise to doctrines like preemptive action and homeland security, demonstrating how the United States concentrated on implementing unilateral policies by adopting a strategy towards, again, guaranteeing security vis-a-vis everyone and despite everyone. The future of Latin America and US national security plans, at least in the short term, was thus relegated to a back burner. Just as multilateralism was the mechanism par excellence for solving conflicts on the international plane. In the 8 years of the George W. Bush presidency, the US returned to a vertical unilateralism, with extraordinary implications for international security and to the relative abandonment of some of the regions allegedly of importance for the US, such as Latin America. The relationship between the US and Latin America plummeted to its lowest point during the administration of President Bush. The US reaction to the terrorist attacks was exclusionary, which deepened the distance with a region that did not share its anti-terrorist obsession, which was, of course, very legitimate when it was built up as a doctrine. In this context, the distance between the two Americas was determined by the US setting foreign policy priorities based on immediate considerations and the return to hard power, meaning military solutions as the way to reposition the US at a time when it was going through a crisis of hegemony intensified by the president's highly ideological foreign and national security policies. That particular moment favored the plans of the neoconservative elite, which in George Soros' opinion used the terrorist threat as a cover for laying out a foreign policy already designed by this group that dominated the Bush White House. In effect, in the national security strategy designed in 2002 as the official response to the September 11 attacks, Latin America would theoretically fit into each of the lines of action. However, its strategic importance is only mentioned in two sections: the chapter dealing with diffusing regional conflicts and in the chapter that talks about the new era of global economic growth. The former proposes the formation of flexible coalitions with with countries like Mexico, Brazil, Chile, and Venezuela, and Colombia. Colombia, not Venezuela, with which the US identifies shared risk, particularly the priorities involving the fight against activities related to or derived from drug trafficking and extremist groups in Colombia. In the second chapter, the framers attempted to dredge up and make a priority of the dubious proposal to create the Free Trade Area of the Americas, the famous FTAA, planned for 2005 and dealt with at the Mar del Plata Summit. Part of this proposal is the importance of signing free trade agreements with Chile and Central America and the need to resolve trade disputes with Mexico and the European Union. The hemisphere as a whole is also included in the energy issue, and a very specific proposal is made about implementing a program equivalent to the African Growth and Opportunity Act for the Caribbean Basin. The Bush administration's heightened disinterest in the region has its most immediate precedent in the conservative philosophy that dominated all White House policies at the time. This philosophy is very well expressed in the project of the New American Century, a think tank founded in 1997 by Robert Kagan and William Kristol. The central question around which this initiative developed was whether the US has the capability to mold the new century in favor of Washington's principles and interests. It also openly recognizes that the country will be in danger if it did not meet the challenge of exercising global total leadership. This document, both a faithful and an enthusiastic reflection of neoconservative discourse, openly proposed the recovering of the principles that made the Reagan administration successful: a strong military, ready to face any challenge, a foreign policy that boldly promotes US principles, and a national leadership that will accept the U.S. global responsibilities. And its needs are clearly reflected in Bush's policies: an increased defense budget, stronger ties with the allies, and the condemnation of regimes hostile to the United States' interests and values, the promotion of the cause of political and economic freedom abroad, and the acceptance of the U.S. unique role and responsibility for preserving and spreading an international order friendly to U.S. security, prosperity, and principles. Clearly, all the futures that define hard power. All this leads to the conclusion that Latin America was simply not included as one of the highest priority regions for several reasons: because it was not a fertile breeding ground for terrorist cells that threaten U.S. national security, because it continues to be thought of as the United States' backyard. Thus, it does not represent, with the current exception of Mexico, a major serious national security crisis at this moment, because specific issues of interest can be more easily handled piecemeal, or because the supremacy of hard power relegates to the back burner issues that can be dealt with by non-military means. The fact is that, despite the discourse, Latin America was pushed down to second or third place. It is understandable that the distancing between the Colossus of the North and the rest of the southern region was not only the result of the 9/11 terrorist attacks, given that it had already insinuated itself into President Bush's plans when he occupied the White House. Nevertheless, his administration began a war against terrorism and parallelly neglected its neighboring prime zone towards return, securing and ensure territorial security in such a geopolitical essential spot. By putting such a high priority on terrorism, the United States neglected other issues that were also very important in the sphere of hemispheric security. The return of the Republicans to the presidency in 2001 and domination of right-wing extremism fixed the presidential sights on recovering military strength in other strategic regions. Once the Cold War was over, Latin America was no longer a region in dispute ideologically, and the nature of its political systems did not seem to be at great or high risk. A string of missed opportunities is the way the current relationship between the two Americas can be best described at the time, in the sense that the United States forgot its promise of making its relationship with Latin America a priority, and issues that are de facto related to each other, like migration, drug trafficking, security, and democratic governance, have been fragmented. This is why, in the very design of a monothematic foreign policy agenda, terrorism, a project of regional integration that included common prosperity and a stable political process at its most important boon, was irrationally postponed, conditioning it, more in rhetoric than in reality, to advances in democracy and security in some of the countries down south. Different perspectives have been proposed for interpreting relations between the U.S. and Latin America since the idea of the Western Hemisphere was conceived, based on the existence of a special relationship between the two Americas, because they shared values, interests, and common goals. Nevertheless, more than representative the web of relationships between the two Americas, this concept reflects the United States' geopolitical worldview in this area of influence. Thus, and I quote, "The term Western Hemisphere is linked to the archetypical geopolitical notion prevailing in the United States, whereby the Western tradition and or the American version of it had to have conditions for settling itself within a geographical piece of the American map." I argue that this term is a territorial extension and an ontological representation of the U.S. conviction that the American creed and thereafter the American way were the philosophical pillars of its conception of civilization. The concepts of inter-American community and Pan-Americanism used during the Kennedy and Nixon administrations to support their respective foreign policies flow from this vision. However, their relevance in the 21st century is questionable, particularly since the end of the Cold War, when U.S. and global foreign policies have changed their battlefronts and fundamental priorities, and the democracies in Latin America have taken alternate paths and are relatively stable. In addition to the idea of the Western Hemisphere, Roberto Russell recognizes three other visions: that of the growing irrelevance of Latin America, that of the imperialist will and practice, and a fourth one, that of the decline of U.S. hegemony in Latin America, particularly in South America. For example, the distancing suggested here is not an argument in favor of the focus about the region's irrelevance, given that there is a substantial difference between being not very important and being a secondary priority among the issues on the U.S. security agenda. In this regard, Russell says, the fact that other countries or regions of the world are at the center of Washington's radar does not make Latin America unimportant. Latin America migration to the north is undoubtedly relevant as an issue of intermestic policy, particularly in the scheme of border security, just as the need to ensure regional trade flows is. But its exclusion or inclusion in an overall security strategy only show the clumsiness, convenient omission, or right choice of decision makers in Washington. With a reductionist reading, energy alliances could shore up the theory of the imperialist will and practice. It is true that the region has been the stage for imperialist challenges and embridled pragmatism, but it will be risky to suggest that every U.S. move toward the South has been absolutely perverse. It is true that there have been economic pressure interventions and a deepening of asymmetries, but this kind of unidirectionally on Washington's part and generalized sustained Latin American docility do not jive with the complexity of national and regional dynamics. Oil trade with Venezuela, for instance, on the one hand, and the difference with Chavez regime on the other, might be cynically convenient, but they respond to a legitimate national security need, guaranteeing energy supply. Mendoza Sanchez says it very well. The Americans' perception of the world as seen through the eyes of a great power necessarily passes through the prism of realpolitik. Finally, there is a crisis of hegemony. Yes, but in the international system, just as convulsed. While 9/11 served as a catalyst for the crisis and the superpower's foreign policy turn, it deepened into growing anti-Americanism, the strengthening of both state and non-state spheres of power, and the diversification of foreign policy issues, very often overlapping with domestic ones. That is, the decline in hegemony might well be happening, but it is also probable that it is really a dip in U.S. hegemony as a result of the evolution of the international system, exacerbated by a series of specific unfortunate presidential decisions like the ones previously mentioned. The discussion of how Latin America fits into the national security and hemispheric security paradigm needs to be dealt with. Why has there not been a significant effort to integrate the hemisphere with regard to security? Is the U.S. really interested in getting involved in a hemisphere-wide security effort? Regardless of the focus used to analyze relations and of the conflict between security paradigms, national or hemispheric, the underlying factor derived from the traditionally paradigmatic U.S. hegemony has been Washington's reticence to accept reciprocity in its foreign relations. Has this changed? The disinterest and lack of thoughtfulness in Bush's Latin American policy are part of the big puzzle whose central pieces are the absence of understanding, sensitivity, and mutual knowledge. That is, it is proximity and result on both sides for many reasons. For the US, security agendas are non-negotiable. For that same reason, agendas of common risks can also not be agreed upon mutually. When US security is in question, it is the U.S. that establishes the canons, and in the name of defending its own security, it commits excesses. In some places, human rights violations against its nationals and foreigners, the Patriot Act, demands for harmonization of security policies, which in the name of hemispheric security either subordinate or mishandle issues that are priorities for the Latin American countries. We can clearly see that the scenario has changed with the arrival of Obama's team to the White House, in my personal view. Today, however, no hemispheric project has had sufficient way to be viable and or doable. The Security and Prosperity Partnership of North America, the SPP, seems to be the only regional and exhausted security mechanism. And there, the US imposed its will because it proposed it. In it, security strategies subordinate the Mexican regional prosperity priorities to a great extent. Without going further into an analysis of the SPP, it jumps out at us that in the gamut of regional or hemispheric frames of action, surprisingly, migration continues to be ignored. Well, not so when it comes to actors aiming at complicating the issue even more, as it has occurred as a result of the decision of Arizona's powers to constrain civil liberties. And this is the case despite its implications as a risk to a border security for sending, receiving, and transit countries. In addition, the partnership was forged in the framework of an increasingly unilateral measures by Washington, like the militarization of the border with Mexico and the proliferation of anti-immigrant civilian actions as seen and already mentioned in Arizona. The trend toward bilateral relations dominates US relations with the hemisphere in all of the subtopics of integration, whether in matters of trade or security, and it is around the security issue that Washington has fostered its greatest bilateral commitments, above all with Mexico and Canada. The negative interpretation of the phenomenon arising out of US hegemony is that it will not necessarily need at all to commit itself in a multilateral game in which it does not obtain the benefits it obtains from the bilateralization of its relations, be it concerning policies to fight drug trafficking or to defend energy security. From a different point of view, regionalism based on bilateral relations with the dominant actor, the US, can be justified by A, the enormous and deep differences dominating relations among the Latin American countries, B, the asymmetries with the United States, and C, the degree of importance that the issue of risk has when the US weighs its priorities. Four cases exemplify the bilateralization of regional security issues. Colombia and Mexico with regard to militarization due to drug trafficking, and Brazil and Venezuela in the negotiations around the issue of energy security. US fragmentation of security strategy has led to the implementation of bilateral models like the Plan Colombia and the Mérida Initiative, and different aid packages to fight against drug trafficking in Colombia, Mexico, Central America, and the Caribbean. Certainly, a different level of cooperation from that of the certification process that from 1986 to 2002 were the central tool for cooperation regarding the fight against drugs. Since 2000, Colombia has received an investment of about US $5 billion to fight drug trafficking and the guerrillas. There are contradictory perceptions of the results of the Colombia program. According to one US Justice Department official, this might be the most important investment today in terms of results dollar per dollar. On the other hand, Ricardo Vargas of the Andean Initiative says that since the plan has been in place, there has been no drop in the drug supply in the United States. The prices to the consumer have tended to drop, the quality of the drugs tends to rise, and in general, their availability has not been affected. He even says that the drug cartels and their links to the guerrillas have been strengthened. In Mexico, the situation is even more delicate, not just because of the risks that seem implicit in the acting of organized crime, drug trafficking, and the massive flow of migrants, but also because of the type of relationship that has been built with its northern neighbor. There is deeply rooted confusion about the definition of relations between Mexico and the United States, which are not as formal as they could be due to an imperfect and unnecessary friendship and a not very prosperous and urgently needy society. Basing the relationship on friendship and not on a partnership has been a historical mistake. It tends to compromise the national interest of the less powerful actor given the absence of reciprocity and recognition of mutual priorities. In addition, parallel to this, little importance is placed on the risky complexity of our geographical proximity and dual identity, being part of Anglo and Hispanic America, and the lack of agreement on bilateral and multilateral policy issues. It will seem that the geographic realities act to the detriment of Mexico, since its proximity to the US limits and reduces sometimes more as a result of Mexico's confusion about knowing what it wants, instead of broad broadening Mexican international policy opportunities. However, because of this, because of its proximity and interdependence with the US and the phenomenon arising from this, Mexico, even more than Canada, is an actor of the highest importance for preserving US security. Proof of this is the SPP initiative and the existence of NORAD, the North American Aerospace Defense Command. As a result of the unfortunate link that has been drawn between migration and terrorism since 9/11, and given the risk of undesired crossings, the aforementioned militarization of the whole security strategy became a reality along the border. Not even in the design of smart borders did the United States think about adopting a multilateral focus involving Mexico, Canada, and the US to reinforce the idea of a shared North America. It simply preferred to negotiate bilaterally, and Mexico accepted stricter border controls and explicitly and implicitly a more rigid migratory regime as its own. The Merit Initiative, as you know, passed by the US Senate in May 2008, initially also budgeted $1.4 billion for fighting drug trafficking and organized crime. The law stipulated that Mexico will receive $400 million in the first year, US $85 million less than what President Bush had proposed. Seven Central American countries and two Caribbean countries, the Dominican Republic and Haiti, are included in this initiative, with $65 million earmarked for them. It should be mentioned that this bill was not approved without frictions, since the US legislature wanted to establish conditions regarding policy transparency and the prosecution of members of the military, accused of human rights violations for paying out the aid, which amounted to suggesting intervention in Mexico's internal affairs. The bilateral effort should go beyond programs like the Merit Initiative, like President Clinton just mentioned in Acapulco 3 days ago, calling it the Mexico Initiative, and urging the Mexican and the US authorities in order to launch such an initiative. In fact, it is very probable that the Merit Initiative has already been overtaken by current events, as can be seen in some reports produced in Washington in different departments. As a matter of fact, the whole war on drugs is considered a failure. Just read the op-ed of the Wall Street Journal in which former Latin American presidents prompt for a paradigm shift in drug policies in the opposite direction to eradication, interdiction, and criminalization of consumption towards an approach that focuses on reducing consumer market, transforming drugs into a public health problem. This affirmation of the failure makes us question the strategies that are being undertaken. According to this proposal, the Merida initiative is definitively narrow. Most of the budget is going to the item of counter-narcotics, counter-terrorism, and border security, not to the social aspect of it. To make matters worse, the recent reduction of $100 million of financial assistance provided by the initiative and the decision just taken by Capitol Hill to delay the sending of the helicopters and aircrafts to Mexico are sending the wrong signals in the intention, if the intention is to ensure the compromise of the binational stakeholders. However, legalization of drugs remains to be considered a taboo, and its enactment is far from probable both in Mexico and the US. Subsequently, the Mexican presidency and the federal institutions involved need to reconsider their strategies and order of priorities in order to succeed on the war of drugs and to have an impact on the US management of its share of the mess. The US response has started to timidly to take place. For instance, on February 25th, US Attorney General Eric Holder announced the results of the 21-month operation Accelerator that included 755 arrests, some of them linked to the Sinaloa cartel, 23 tons of narcotic seized, and 169 weapons, vehicles, ships, and even planes, plus $59 million in cash and $6.5 million in other assets. And yet, to contribute in launching more integrated operations, Mexico needs to come up with some constructive, comprehensive, relatively serious agenda that makes sense. In short, Mexico has to become a credible and a viable partner. There are two very important examples as to how we can regard this foreign policy very pragmatic foreign policy on the part of the United States. One is Brazil, and the other is Venezuela. It's important to see and to exemplify this pragmatism in U.S.-Venezuela relations, presenting some figures. The U.S., for instance, regarding energy security, imports 63% of all the oil it consumes domestically, meaning 13 million barrels a day in 2007, or 25% of world oil consumption. Its main suppliers are Canada, Saudi Arabia, Mexico, and Venezuela, in order of volume. On the other hand, the growth rate in imports from Brazil makes it the country with the third fastest growing rate among crude oil suppliers. Canada is in eighth place already, and Venezuela 10th, making Brazil and Venezuela the only Latin American countries among the first of the list. Meanwhile, despite the fact that Mexico has increased its exports 211% since 2003, indicators for 2006 and 2007 show a 0.1% reduction on the part of Mexico in exports to the United States, which means that Mexico, of course, needs urgently to change the paradigm regarding, of course, energy and make an urgent reform in the Constitution. So the U.S. strategic alliance with Brazil was not only a good idea, but necessary as part of the search for allies in the region with which relations are not as conflictive as with Mexico. The big difference between relations with Mexico and relations with Brazil is that the United States recognized Brazil as an ally, and Brazil, in turn, demanded to be treated as a partner. In addition, to embodying an inclusive multilateral leadership, a partnership with Brazil will represent a decisive strengthening of ties with the Mercosur bloc and an immediate link to the rest of South America. Simply put, the Mercosur nations altogether represent 45% of the population of Latin America and the Caribbean, almost 60% of regional gross domestic product, more than 40% of U.S. investment in the region, but less than 15% of U.S. trade. For practical reasons, there seems to be recognition between the U.S. and Brazil that their agreements are more important than their disagreements. They have other relations with others, specifically the discord between the United States and Venezuela and Lula's relatively cordial relationship with Chavez. Brazil is a global player, member of the BRICS. It has opened most of its economy to international competition. It plays an important role in world trade and in trade negotiations. Together with India and South Africa, Brazil activism and influence in the global south is dominant, and as it is among the medium-sized powers, including Mexico, despite the reticence with which our country deals with its responsibilities and prerogatives. With regard to alternative energy sources, the U.S. has sought to establish an energy alliance with Brazil, then, in order to increase ethanol use to reduce fossil fuel consumption, and some will argue to reduce Venezuela influence. Why Brazil? Because it is the largest exporter of ethanol and a leader in biofuel technology, particularly for fuels produced from sugarcane, which is more efficient than U.S.-produced corn-based fuel. The fact is that situations change. And in line with the hegemonic theory, U.S. supremacy has an irregular course as long as it continues to want to maintain its position as dominant power, something which, despite the aforementioned crisis, does not seem to be nearing an end. The hegemony presumption, a term coined by Abraham Lowenthal to describe regional relations with the United States, existed and was effective in a context of bipolar competition characteristic of the Cold War. However, in today's international order, the idea of a Western Hemisphere as an inclusive, generalizing concept is no longer valid. The image of a consolidated backyard no longer fits in with the very diverse nature of 21st century Latin America countries either. That is, this whole notion of U.S. hegemony over Latin America seems to have definitively lost its validity vis-a-vis the increased power of middle powers such as Brazil. At the end of the Bush administration, relations with Latin America were not completely healthy. And among the superpowers' political liabilities might be counted the limited communication and prevailing mistrust in inter-American relations. The current fronts will continue to exist. Terrorism will keep its place as the number one priority. but Latin America will also continue growing and projecting itself as a region of dynamic, influential, diversified actors. These are all weighty reasons for the U.S. to revisit the relationship with renewed vigor, not with timid approaches, but with fresh focuses that do not solely encompass the interests of Washington. And perhaps this has started to happen in the light of the renewed interest that the Obama administration has shown in the form of its various and diversified approaches through which Washington is seeking and perhaps proposing a new strategy aside from the mere issue of security at the expense of a healthy and credible relationship with the continent. Not that the United States is the main responsible for this to happen, but given the interdependent asymmetry in the inter-American relationship, there is, of course, a strong weight on the side of Washington. The future of political and economic sustainability might be at stake. Thank you very much.